Many Americans are actively worried about Ukraine right now as the Russian invasion grinds into its second year. What is Putin's deal, we ask? Is he trying to distract his own people from domestic challenges? Has he just succumbed to paranoid delusions about the West's plot to thwart Russian sovereignty by steadily growing NATO membership? Without defending Russian aggression, Putin's thinking seems a lot less bizarre when you do a thought exercise. Imagine how the U.S. might respond if, say, the sovereign state of Mexico made a deal to allow China to store warships and bombers in its territory. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Christopher Lane is University Distinguished Professor of International Affairs and Robert M. Gates Chair in National Security at Texas A&M University. His article for Harper's, written with Benjamin Schwartz, drew our attention because it really helps illustrate what is at stake from Russia's perspective and how any settlement of the conflict in Ukraine will need to account for Russia's perceptions of NATO. The piece is titled, "Why Are We in Ukraine?" Chris, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
Let's just start here. This is a really dangerous moment in history, even when compared with what we consider the height of the Cold War, like the Bay of Pigs crisis. What makes the situation so uniquely perilous right now?
Well, every international crisis, I suppose, is unique in its own ways. But yet, as students of international politics and history, we're always looking for similarities. And actually, I think a lot of people in Washington are being excessively complacent about the potential dangers of this situation. I was speaking with a colleague yesterday, and I think the historical analogy that came to both our minds was the summer of 1914. After Archduke Franz Ferdinand was assassinated, I believe on June 28, 1914, most of Europe was completely oblivious to the fact that there was a serious crisis brewing that ultimately would culminate in World War I. And the tension really did not get focused on that among people outside decision-making circles until basically the last week before the war started in 1914. Anybody who's read the headlines in today's paper will see that there have been drone strikes on Moscow for the first time, despite the fact that the U.S. government ostensibly has warned Ukraine not to attack Russian territory. The potential for escalation is high. You're talking about a proxy war between the United States and NATO and Russia. And there are a number of things that could go wrong and open up the possibility of escalation. And I think decision makers need to be more attentive to that and realize that there are real risks and dangers.
When you say proxy war, I mean, the United States is openly providing weapon support to Ukraine. We're providing some intelligence assistance. You write it's also possible that the U.S. may have committed some covert acts of war against Russia since the invasion of Ukraine. What are you talking about there? What forms might that covert war have taken?
Well, when I say proxy war, I'm really referring to the kinds of things you just mentioned. The weapons that we're giving Ukraine, the training that we're giving Ukraine, the real-time intelligence we're giving Ukraine so that they can target, they've killed senior Russian officers with real-time intelligence provided by the United States. I obviously have no access to secret information, but we do know, because it's appeared in the newspapers, like the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, that there are actually a small number, I want to be clear, a small number of special forces troops from the United States and other NATO countries advisors, but one never knows. There seems to be sort of a dual message coming from the Biden administration. On the one hand, we tell the Ukrainians not to do certain things like attack targets in Russia. We tell them that we won't give them the weapons that would allow them to do that. But at the same time, when they do that, there doesn't seem to be any pushback by the Biden administration. I mean, there's certainly no threat that the Biden administration and NATO are going to suddenly turn off the spigot on the flow of arms to Ukraine. And of course, now we have the matter of F-16 fighter jets, which could easily target Russian territory. In fact, they could hit targets in Russia just flying over Ukrainian airspace with some of the weapon systems they can carry. So, you know, President Biden at the very beginning of this war said there would be no U.S. boots on the ground. I have no doubt in my mind that he meant that. But if you go back and you look at the history, for example, of the Vietnam War, Presidents Eisenhower and Kennedy and Johnson were all pretty much saying the same thing. If you want to go back further in history, you know that it was 6 to 8 months before the United States entered World War I, President Wilson ran for re-election on the platform he kept us out of war. In late 1940, during the presidential election, Franklin Roosevelt said that Americans would not go to fight a European war. And a year later, they were. So, you know, circumstances change, situations change. And what worries me and Ben Schwartz, and I think was one of the reasons we felt prompted to write this article, is there is the real risk of escalation. Just take one example, probably the most important example. The Ukrainian government has made very clear that their only peace terms that they will accept is, as their foreign minister put it last week, the return of every square meter of sovereign Ukrainian territory, quote unquote, occupied by the Russians. That includes Crimea, where there is a serious, justifiable Russian claim that Crimea really should be part of Russia. So I think that's, you know, to use that overused phrase, red lines, I think that's pretty clear that that is one of the Kremlin's red lines. But we know that one of the possible targets of the Ukrainian counteroffensive that we've been all waiting for with bated breath is possibly to regain Crimea. And if the Russians were in a situation where they believed that Ukraine was on the verge of reclaiming Crimea, that would be a dangerous situation. That would be a situation where they might use tactical nuclear weapons. And once you start down that road, you just don't know where it's going to end. So I guess we see this as something where American foreign policymakers don't really seem to be fully cognizant of the risks that they're running.
So U.S. officials talk about this conflict in terms of Vladimir Putin's psychology, right? So the idea is that Putin is maybe somehow unhinged. But even if we absolutely disagree with the decision to invade Ukraine, you don't see the choice Putin made as entirely irrational. His primary grievance is the expansion of NATO?
I think that's absolutely right. And the focus on Putin diverts attention from a lot of really important aspects of this crisis. And it's really quite amazing to me, although I suppose I've studied American foreign policy long enough, I really shouldn't be surprised. We do tend to demonize our opponents. We do tend to personalize conflicts. But just as there's a foreign policy establishment in Washington, there's one in Moscow, too. It's not just Vladimir Putin who has been worried about NATO expansion. Since the Cold War ended, or was on the verge of ending, the last three leaders of Russia, the Soviet Union in its dying days, Mikhail Gorbachev, Boris Yeltsin, and now Vladimir Putin, have all been strongly opposed to NATO expansion. The Russian foreign policy elite has been opposed to NATO expansion. And this is why I think personalizing this conflict misses a lot of important things. You know, Russia has a long history, not just the Soviet Union, but Russia before the Soviet Union, then the Soviet Union, then post-Soviet Russia. There is a strong continuity. There is a political culture. There is a history. There is a sense of what Russia's place in the world is. And it seems to me that American policymakers have completely ignored the fact that Russia has political, geopolitical traditions that would make it extremely sensitive to NATO expansion. Remember, NATO expansion, it has not just taken in states like Poland and Hungary and the Czech Republic that were Soviet satellites. It's taken in the Baltic states, which were actually part of Soviet territory, and before World War I, part of the Russian Empire. So, it's hard to convey this, but one of the good places to start is by going back to the great American diplomat George F. Kennan's famous long telegram that he sent to the State Department in 1946 when he was stationed at the Moscow embassy. And this was supposed to be an analysis of what Soviet motives were, what we could expect from them in post-World War II foreign policy terms. But he didn't start by focusing on communism or ideology. The first thing he focused on was what he called, I believe it's a direct quote, Russia's historic sense of insecurity. And American policymakers certainly should be capable of understanding this. So again, it's not just Vladimir Putin. And you know, I only half jokingly say that if we were to get on a plane from DFW and head for Washington and get off and visit some of the offices of people in the mainstream foreign policy establishment think tanks, and also some of the people in the government, and we looked at the maps in their offices, we would find that the term Russia has been excised and replaced by Putania. This is focus on everything is Putin, everything is reduced to Putin, but it's not. There is a Russian foreign policy establishment, and there is a Russian sense of history and its place in the world that we need to understand. And if we don't, we're going to have some problems.
Is it reasonable for Putin to view the expansion of NATO as an existential threat? I mean, NATO has no designs on invading Russia. What could it do to limit the autonomy Putin perceives?
Well, the analogy that you gave on the intro to the program was actually very, very good. And I'll just elaborate on it. If the People's Republic of China were to reach an agreement with Mexico that allowed for the Chinese People's Liberation Army to station troops on the Rio Grande, allowed China to have air bases and naval bases in Mexico, how would the United States react to that? I think we know how the United States would react to that. And we also have historical precedent. The Cuban Missile Crisis tells us that the United States reacted very strongly when a hostile power sought to emplace military forces in the Western Hemisphere.
Chris, what sorts of promises were made or implied about NATO membership at the time the Soviet Union was breaking apart?
You know, that is a terrific question, and it's one that I guess in the jargon of political science, I would say is contested. Everyone who's interested in this issue should probably read Mary Surratt's book, Not One Inch Back, which is about the negotiations for German reunification, and then the subsequent Clinton administration decision to expand NATO. I think the best answer is it's unclear. Secretary of State Baker did seemingly make certain promises to the Soviets, to Gorbachev and Edward Shevardnadze, his foreign minister, during the German reunification talks. Other officials from other countries, particularly Hans-Dietrich Genscher, who was the German foreign minister, made more explicit comments. So I think if you're trying to construct a case from the Russian side that they were sold a bill of goods during the German reunification, say, commitment was made that NATO would not be expanded, I think they have a case, but it's not an open and shut case. But more to the point, I think, is the fact that U.S. policymakers knew or should have known what was going to happen. And George Kennan, who I already mentioned, who I think was rightly considered to be the foremost U.S. expert on the Soviet Union and Russia after World War II, said in a New York Times op-ed article that he wrote in 1997 when the Clinton administration pushed ahead with the first round of NATO expansion, that this was a historic mistake and would lead to really serious consequences in terms of U.S. relations with Russia. Now, one could back up and say, well, you know, the Russians made a lot of noise, but that's all they did during the first two rounds of NATO expansion. But it's Ukraine is in a different context, and that the Russians were willing to acquiesce. I won't use the word accept. I will use the word acquiesce in the first two rounds of NATO expansion very reluctantly. But Ukraine was a separate, different issue for them. And what's very interesting to me, and people should probably be aware of this, in 2008, NATO held its annual summit in Bucharest, Romania. And the George W. Bush administration wanted to offer Ukraine NATO membership. And that was discussed at the highest levels of the George W. Bush administration. And the then U.S. ambassador to Russia, William Burns, who is now director of the CIA, wrote a memo to Secretary of State Rice, Condoleezza Rice, and said, and I think it's a direct quote, "Ukraine as a member of NATO is the reddest of all red lines for Moscow." So that this was different, that the Soviets may have sort of, pardon me, the Russians may have just allowed NATO expansion to go ahead in its first two rounds without doing more than gripe about it. But Ukraine was a different category, and that the consequences of taking Ukraine into NATO would be much, much more serious. And again, I want to quote that from the U.S., then U.S. ambassador to Russia in 2008, offering Ukraine membership in NATO is the reddest of all red lines for Russia. Well, we didn't care. And I think it's a pretty consistent pattern of going back to the end of the Cold War of really not taking Russian objections to certain policies like NATO expansion very seriously. And the United States was very powerful when the Cold War ended. Russia was very weak. And it was pretty easy to just bulldoze aside their Russian objections and go ahead with U.S. policy. But I think that, you know, then Ambassador Burns was making a point that should have made a deeper impression on Washington. And then actually just the outcome of that NATO summit in Bucharest in 2008. France and Germany objected to offering membership to Ukraine. So there was a compromise that Ukraine would become a member of NATO at some undefined point in time. But at that particular point in time, no action membership plan would be offered to Ukraine. So it's holding out this in the long term, we're going to let Ukraine in. But in the short term, we're not going to take any concrete steps to doing that. And for the Russians, that was unacceptable because it did mean that at some level, at some point in time, Ukrainian membership for NATO was in the cards.
Did the U.S. support regime change in Ukraine around the time Viktor Yanukovych, who had been friendly to Moscow, was being ousted?
Well, I'm not sure I would say that U.S. I wouldn't phrase it that way. But let's just walk back and see what happened. When the Soviet Union was in its death throes in 1990-91, lots of people, both in Washington and in Kiev and in Moscow, recognized that if the Soviet Union broke up and Ukraine became an independent state, that the potential for friction between Russia and Ukraine in a post-Soviet world would be very high. And when I say friction, I mean war. People understood that there, at some point, could be a war between Russia and independent Ukraine. And really, there's another outstanding book, if anybody's interested in following this. It's the kind of a book I always tell my students that if I threw it at them, would be Assault with a Deadly Weapon, because it's so thick. But it's Vladislav Zubok's book, and he's a professor at the London School of Economics. It's called Collapse, The Fall of the Soviet Union. And he traces these events that led to the Soviet collapse in great detail. And the issue of Crimea, which not only Russia has a historic claim to, but the fact that its Black Sea Fleet was based in Sevastopol in Crimea, this was recognized as a potential post-Cold War flashpoint. President George H.W. Bush gave a very famous speech in Kiev, I believe in August 1991, just a few months before the Soviet Union ultimately collapsed. And I think it was the late New York Times op-ed columnist William Sapphire labeled this the so-called Chicken Kiev speech, because President Bush said in no uncertain terms, speaking to the Ukrainians, that giving in to nationalist impulses in a possible post-Soviet world would be dangerous and something that they should be well advised to avoid. So President George H.W. Bush understood what could happen in terms of nationalist rivalries between Russia and Ukraine if the Soviet Union broke up. So, you know, I think that the George H.W. Bush administration certainly did not pursue regime change in the Soviet Union. It tried to do what it could. Perhaps it didn't do enough, but it certainly understood that the Soviet dissolution could have really serious geopolitical consequences, and it wanted to avoid those. So we ended up, however, with the Soviet Union breaking up and Ukraine becoming an independent state with all that implied.
How did the United States try to influence domestic Russian politics in the mid-90s?
By giving some material support to the Russian Republic, economic aid. I think people don't realize that in 1990-91, how bad the economic situation was in the Soviet Union in terms of literally the difficulty of being able to find food or any kind of consumer goods. So the U.S. did try in sort of a half-hearted way to alleviate that. The Clinton administration tried to give the Russians sort of the appearance that we were taking them seriously and trying to reintegrate them into a post-Cold War Europe by making them offers not of NATO membership, which at one term they, point in time, the Yeltsin administration did aspire to, but giving them this partnership for peace, sort of a, you know, a runner-up version of NATO membership. But I think at the end of the day, it's a harsh judgment, but I think it's a correct judgment that during the Clinton administration, George W. Bush administration, the U.S. did not really pay that much attention to anything other than making sure that the Russians were never provoked to use their nuclear weapons against the United States or Western Europe. And there was really no threat, no crisis that would have raised that possibility. So I think, I hate to use this term, but I will, that the post-Cold War U.S. administrations basically followed a policy of benign neglect towards Russia. We had to engage them on arms control. We engaged them on other issues, but we didn't take their concerns very seriously.
Chris, obviously there are a lot of strong member states within NATO. Is it possible, though, to separate the will of the United States from the will of NATO?
Well, listen, I'm going just to give you my honest opinion. NATO is an instrument of American dominance in Europe and was created as such. And in fact, in some ways, when NATO was created, it was not just to contain the Soviet Union. It was also, in a sense, to contain Germany and France and Western Europe so that they would not emerge as independent poles of power in the international system. I think many of your listeners will be familiar with the term unipolarity or unipolar world, which was coined in 1991 when the Soviet Union collapsed and the so-called bipolar Cold War world of two superpowers was transformed into a world where there was only one great power, the United States. But in fact, as I detail, based on a lot of archival research in my book, The Peace of Illusions, that the goal of creating a unipolar world animated U.S. foreign policymakers even during World War II. And the fact that the Soviet Union got in the way of that during the Cold War did not manage to push the thought of being a dominant unipole out of the minds of the American foreign policy establishment. So the United States has always fought back hard against any European attempts to assert any kind of real independence in terms of geopolitical policy, in terms of military policy from the United States. So for all the presentation of NATO as this great multilateral alliance between the U.S. and Europe, it's really, that's a fiction. That's a figment of, well, I guess what I would call perception management coming out of Washington, D.C. and Brussels. NATO is an alliance dominated by the United States. The military chain of command in NATO runs from the SACEUR, who is the Supreme Allied Commander in Europe, who has always been an American, directly to the White House. Doesn't run to the Elysee Palace in Paris. Doesn't run to the Chancellor in Berlin. It runs to the President of the United States. And so, yeah, the NATO presents itself as being sort of multilateral, but it's not an alliance of equals. It's an alliance dominated by American power.
So is it your sense that the primacy of NATO interferes with more pragmatic ways European member states might negotiate disagreements with Russia?
Well, that's a really good question, and I think it's a very good point. Actually, there's a story that I just read online before we started the show in the Financial Times. It was just posted within the last 45 minutes that President Macron of France is proposing some kind of path to NATO membership for Ukraine as part of a settlement of this conflict, which I think is sort of a somewhat subtle shift from what France's policy has been up to this point. But you know, you sort of have what Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld called during the Iraq War the old Europe and the new Europe. You know, the old Europe, Germany, France, the Low Countries, Spain, Italy, and the new Europe, the Baltic states, Poland, and Romania. And I guess now we'd have to throw in Finland and Sweden, although I'm not Sweden still hasn't officially become a member because Turkey is blocking that still. But those countries all border Russia. They all have a very hard line about what NATO policy should be towards Russia. Whereas some of the other countries, particularly the French and Germans historically, have had a much different view of their relations with Russia. And so I think it's very interesting to see what the dynamics of this are going to be. The U.S., there's a story about this in the Wall Street Journal this morning, is supporting the convening of an international peace conference without the Russians. This is really a peace settlement, at least gathering what we know so far, would be on Ukraine's terms. And Ukraine's terms has been made clear time and time again by President Zelensky and his foreign minister. Every inch of Ukrainian soil that is occupied by Russia must be returned to Ukraine. If this is really the bottom line, it's going to be a long time before this war ends, because the Russians will never agree to that.
Chris, you mentioned that Ukraine's terms for ending this conflict are a complete return of all the territory seized by Russia. It sounds like you think that Ukraine's demands here to end this conflict are not just unreasonable, but unrealistic.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it, Chris. President Zelensky said time after time that every inch of Ukrainian territory must be returned. Last week, his foreign minister said that every square meter of Ukrainian territory now occupied by Russia must be returned. And I think that overlooks particularly the salience of Crimea and why it is important to Russia for historic and geographic reasons. It's also inhabited mostly by Russian speakers. So that's a non-starter. And it's also interesting to note that if we go back to March last year, there was actually sort of a brief flurry of peace negotiations between which were sort of mediated by Turkey. And at that point, President Zelensky indicated that it was not necessarily important for Ukraine to be a member of NATO, that Ukraine could accept neutral status, and that maybe not get all its territory back. So one of the things that I think the Biden administration can be criticized for is that the more arms we have given to Ukraine, the more we have fortified Ukraine in pursuing a hardline policy with respect to post-war settlement. And I don't know that that's necessarily the outcome that we want. And also pointing out that the Biden administration is sort of trying to thread a pretty hard needle to thread. On the one hand, we want to give Ukraine enough arms so that they can change the balance of power on the battlefield and force Russia to negotiate, presumably on the basis of Kiev's terms. But at the same time, we may want Ukraine to win, but we should probably worry about them winning too much. Because again, if Ukraine threatened to reoccupy Crimea, that would be a very serious, dangerous point in this war, and one that might very well lead Russia to use tactical nuclear weapons. And if that were to happen, there's just no telling of where events would go after that. We don't know if Russia felt that its grip on Crimea were about to disappear and they decided to use tactical nuclear weapons, that is the kind of severe crisis from their point of view that might lead them to take that step. And the only thing I was going to say is if tactical nuclear weapons come into play, there's no telling of where that would lead. And none of us should want to find out.
Many people listening will have heard these parallels drawn between Vladimir Putin today and Adolf Hitler in the late 1930s, when appeasement strategies famously and catastrophically failed to check Hitler's ambitions. I get the sense that you don't feel like these are useful comparisons.
Completely useless. And I say that somebody who wrote their doctoral dissertation on British policy during the 1930s. So I flatter myself that I know a lot about the history of the 1930s. Vladimir Putin is not Hitler. But again, this is a tendency in American foreign policy to demonize our opponents and also to personalize the nature of the conflict. And I cannot say over and over again enough that this is not just about Vladimir Putin. This is about the Russian foreign policy establishment across the political spectrum in Russia, from the last liberal free market Democrats that are left to the hardline nationalists in Russia. All of them oppose NATO expansion. All of them believe that Crimea is historically and rightfully a part of Russia. And all of them believe that large parts of the Donbas in eastern Ukraine are really historically Russian lands that should be reclaimed by Russia. So it's not just Putin. And, you know, the idea that Putin has the kind of genocidal aims that, Hitler had and implemented, it's just no, it's a silly comparison. It's really not worth taking seriously from an intellectual and historical point of view.
From the Russian perspective, can you talk about some of the international interference that the United States has participated in the last few decades that might appear to be sort of entering into the affairs of sovereign states where the U.S. and NATO had no direct business and there were not credible threats to security?
I'm not sure that I'm quite clear on the question, but if I understand, the U.S. and Russia, since the end of the Cold War, have had what you might term a traditional great power competition in lots of parts of the world outside of Europe, particularly the Middle East. And we've seen this in events in Syria, for example. You know, the Russians pursued their interests, historical interests, in having a role in the Middle East. The United States has sort of jockeyed against that. But that's traditional, normal, great power politics. It's not the kind of thing that likely would ever bring the United States and Russia to the brink of war. So we're not talking about competition for influence in other parts of the world. We're talking about what's going to happen with Ukraine. And, you know, I'm not Russian. I'm not speaking for Russia. I'm simply saying that, you know, if you read enough and you study this enough, you'll know that the Russians think historically that Ukraine is part of Russia. I'm not endorsing that, but I'm trying to explain what their mentality is. But even more than that, they view Ukraine as a member of NATO, as an existential threat to their security. Now, we can try and talk them down from that, but I don't think that that's likely to work. That's just that you have to understand, if you're going to have a successful foreign policy, you have to understand what motivates and drives your adversaries. You have to be able to see the world the way they see it. And I just think there's not that ability in Washington to really put themselves in the place of the Russian foreign policy establishment and understand why, from the Russian point of view, this is such a hot-button issue.
So to be clear, at the moment, Ukraine is not a member of NATO. It doesn't have a direct path to NATO membership. But there are joint military exercises between Ukraine and NATO?
I don't know if you would call them exercises, but the Ukrainian army since 2014 has been trained by NATO advisors. It's been equipped with NATO weapons. It's been provided intelligence. It's in a de facto sense, NATO has pretty much adopted Ukraine as a member, not formally, but which is important, because if it were a formal member of NATO, then Article 5 would come into effect, which says that NATO members have to defend the other NATO members if they're attacked. But in a de facto sense, Ukraine is an appendage of NATO. Its military is dependent on NATO weapons, NATO intelligence, NATO trainers. And I guess we're going to see sometime in the next few months how successful this NATO training has been with the 11 states that have been equipped with tanks and armored fighting vehicles to participate in this spring offensive that the Ukrainians keep promising us that we're going to see. But this is all the result of NATO. I mean, NATO has made Ukraine a military dependent and appendage, and we'll see whether that enables them to win the war. And if it does, well, then that's the next question. Is that a good thing? If they win the war decisively, it may not be.
Chris, at this point, could some kind of firm and binding pledge that Ukraine will break its ties with NATO and never pursue active membership, could that stop the war at this point, or are we past that?
Hard to say. I think that let me just back up. As scholars of international relations, we have theories that we try to use to explain why certain outcomes happen in international politics. And I think one of the ones that's really important here is what we call offensive realism, quote unquote, offensive realism, and it's not a unitary theory. But the general point is that when a state or alliance's capabilities increase, particularly in a relative sense compared to its rivals, its ambitions expand. So, you know, if the Ukrainians were to be very successful on the battlefield, I don't think there would be any support in NATO for going back to the kinds of discussions that the Ukrainians had with Turkey and indirectly with Russia in the spring of 2022. I alluded to those when Zelensky said that he could accept a neutral Ukraine, not a member of NATO, and maybe some territorial readjustments. That if Ukraine wins the war or is perceived to have a decisive upper hand on the battlefield, those things will be off the table, I think. And so that's sort of the paradox, is the more the Ukrainians do well on the battlefield, the less likelihood that they're going to be diplomatically flexible in negotiations, and the less likelihood that NATO and the U.S. are going to pressure them to be more flexible.
So what would have to happen at this point for diplomacy to have a possibility of ending this conflict rather than one side definitively defeated in a military sense?
Well, that's a very great question, and it's a very hard question to answer. Look, I mean, let's go back. What they were talking about in the spring of 2022 was a perfectly viable and realistic plan to end the war. So Russia holds on to what it has in the Donbas. It holds on to Ukraine. NATO does not admit Ukraine as a member. And life goes on. But we've moved past that point. I mean, the Ukrainians clearly are not in the mood to talk about those terms again. I don't think the U.S. really ever was very happy about that. And now, again, the more confidence that the Ukrainians have that they can hold their own on the battlefield and perhaps do more than just hold their own on the battlefield, the less incentive there is for them to walk back from what are now their maximalist demands. And the same token is very clear. You know, we could, if Russia, quote unquote, lost this war and it led to the removal of Vladimir Putin in the Kremlin, the next Russian leader or the one after that would be determined to reverse any loss that Russia suffered in this war. So basically, what the United States and NATO have done by not encouraging more flexibility on the part of Ukrainians is to create a situation that I like to analogize to that of Alsace-Lorraine during the 19th and early 20th centuries. You know, the French and the Germans battled over who had the right to rule over Alsace-Lorraine for over 100 years. And every time one side won, the other side would go back and sulk and regroup and say, well, this isn't acceptable. We're going to rebuild our military power and we're going to change the result in the next one. That could happen very easily in Ukraine. And I think one thing that really should come out in all of this is we need to ask ourselves seriously, what has been the U.S. role in this war, in facilitating the outbreak of this war? Now, the U.S. knew the war was coming. We knew why it was coming. We knew what the Russian demands were. So, I mean, my conclusion is we knew war was coming and we didn't particularly feel motivated to do anything to stop it.
Christopher Lane is University Distinguished Professor of International Affairs and Robert M. Gates Chair in National Security at Texas A&M University. His article for Harper's, written with Benjamin Schwartz, is titled, Why Are We in Ukraine? Chris, thanks for the conversation.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.